nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
What we did, we introduced different classes of metamaterials. We would say there are electrical metamaterials where we can control epsilon by basically engineering that material. Specifically, we're interested in having epsilon, where epsilon is the electric permittivity negative, which is required to accomplish eventually negative refractive index. And that can be accomplished, for example, with these wires, metal wires. And we also considered magnetic metamaterials, which have magnetic response, mu, which can be negative also. And for that particular thing, we considered this so-called split ring resonators, like two C's, one inside of another. And we pointed out that this type of structures, when the magnetic field is perpendicular to the plane of this split ring resonator, can support modes with negative mu. And here is the first pioneering experiment done at UCSD by David Smith, Sheldon Schultz, and their coworkers. So what they used, they basically put together these metal rods and split ring resonators. So, and the idea was that negative electrical metamaterial provided by these rods plus negative magnetic metamaterials associated with these split ring resonators should give negative index metamaterial, where by index I mean refractive index. Okay, the challenge here is in general, a challenge for designing these materials with negative refractive index is not just to have both epsilon and mu negative, but have them negative at the same frequency range. And that's usually, sometimes it's like a fundamental problem. Like in the optical range, it's almost like an extremely, extremely challenging problem, which we, for example, work very hard in my lab to try to overcome it. But the thing is, by controlling the density, of these metal wires, you can actually change the plasma frequency. The plasma frequency omega p, remember I told you, because it's plasma frequency associated is proportional to the density number of free carriers electrons. And by diluting metal, by changing the density, the spacing between these metal rods, you basically on average change the amount of available free electrons. So, and you can, by doing that, you actually can adjust it so that the epsilon is negative at the same frequency as mu. And as for mu, you also can control the frequency at which this negative mu occurs by changing the geometry. Because I told you that this metallic part associated with inductance L, and by changing the length of these C letters in quartz, so you actually change the inductance. And by changing this, the size of the gap, you change the capacitance. So you can also adjust the frequency at which mu becomes negative. So and the goal is to have epsilon mu negative at the same frequency, like here. And if you do have that, here we speak of microwave range, don't forget it. So all structures are kind of millimeter in size. And so it's not. So then you have a structure like this. Well, let's come back to this general formula for waves propagating in the material. Again, it's simply Kz, but K is n refractive index times omega over c, and n is square root of epsilon times mu. If you have only epsilon negative but mu positive, so you have a square root from negative number, which gives you purely imaginary number, therefore the wave should decay. And that's exactly the case. When in this experiment they put only rods, you see, wires alone, then transmission was extremely low. I don't know why it doesn't show the scale, but it should actually, it's extremely low. It's basically nothing goes through. I don't remember, it's like minus some dB, minus 10 dB or whatever. It doesn't go through, basically. Okay, then what you do next, you put only split ring resonators alone. Then in the area where mu is negative, but you don't have rods anymore, so you also have transmission dropping down significantly. Because again, you have now mu negative, but epsilon is positive because there are no roads. Yes?
Which way is the light coming into that array?
That's a good question. The light comes so that the electrical field polarized along the roads and the what is really critical here is that the magnetic field is penetrates through this splitting resonators. So E is along the roads and H is like this. So the light goes this way. Okay, so for wires alone, no transmission. For splitting resonators alone, no transmission, because in both cases you have square root of negative number. Then you put them together and you have this jump in transmittance. Okay, this is band of enhanced transmission. So because in this case you have the product of two negative numbers, which gives you a positive number, and therefore the object starts to transmit. I mean, it was the very first experiment, not perhaps the best one. After that, there were many much better experiments, but that was the first one. This is the first experiment where they demonstrated how you can play with epsilon and mu and control transmittance. And indirectly, that was the first experiment when negative n was involved. Because when both epsilon and mu are negative, it means that n should be negative, as we discussed. But that experiment was kind of criticized. They would say, hey, it's kind of strange system. It's not really two-dimensional. So the next thing they did, the same group, they took two-dimensional structure and they combined it with a waveguide. You see, now you have these splitting resonators, several in the vertical direction, not just one, but several. Okay, and roads are right here. And they also looked in this case at refraction, which is directly related to the refractive index. What they obtain, you see that in the case when you have this structure, so then the direction in which ray after reflection goes is a negative one. When you replace this negative index material with Teflon, which is conventional material, then it goes in opposite direction with respect to the normal. Okay, you see? So here you have negative refractive index minus 2.7. You can simply measure it according to Snell's law. Here, when you replace the negative index material with Teflon of the same size, you have a positive refractive index. That was the first clear demonstration of negative refractive index in the microwave. But still, there was some criticism. There are always some people who love to criticize. They would say that, hey, there was a waveguide. Maybe that waveguide played some tricky role. And then Boeing, the same Boeing which make this aircraft, there is a research group now working there on this project. They made this famous, the Boeing Cube. It's a three-dimensional structure. So no waveguide, nothing. So and they make this wedge, and again demonstrated this negative refractive index. So without any waveguide, it's three-dimensional structure, and clearly the beam went in the negative direction. That was probably the most conclusive experiment in the microwave range. So and how we can move it to the optical range? And the problem is not as simple as one could think, because as I already mentioned, metals in the microwave behave like nearly perfect conductors. So simply epsilon is so huge, they're nearly like perfect conductors in many senses. When you move to the optical range, epsilon negative, but kind of not that large. It's minus 5, 10, or whatever. And it could match actually the positive epsilon of the electric host so that you could have a plasmon resonance. Entirely new way actually to realize optical magnetism and negative refractive index comes into the game when you go to the optical range, which is plasmon resonance. Plasmon resonance, you don't have it in the microwave range. Because to have a plasmon resonance, you have a denominator formula describing your excitations. You have typically epsilon m plus 2 epsilon h, for example. To have it zero, epsilon h is typically, let's say, 2, 3, for glass. You have to have epsilon m of the same scale but negative, but not minus 10,000 or so like in the microwave. So therefore there are no actually plasmon excitation in the microwave. So what I'm saying, in the optical range there is a new very important thing, which is a plasmon resonance. And so many things are different. So the size of the structure becomes comparable to the skin depths. So actually light penetrates through all the structures opposed to microwave structures. Basically, light does not penetrate into these big wires. So And that was a big challenge, actually, to move it to the optical range. And here you see the design which we originally proposed in 2002, this pairs of rods. And the idea is actually goes, and this is the sample we fabricated. Shao Kwan from our group specifically, my student, fabricated this beautiful, beautiful sample. This is AFM picture. So the idea is like here. So you have this pairs of rods, and the light is incident so that the electrical field parallel to the rods and induce these plasmon excitations and provides negative epsilon, whereas H is perpendicular to the pairs of the rods. And since H again varies in time, so you have the varying in time magnetic flux, which according to the Faraday's law should induce this current. Okay, the current which is within the rods is basically conduction current, and which is closed by the displacement current. And as I mentioned already, in the optical range, the displacement current is what in the Maxwell equation associated with D. And this term enters Maxwell equations as dd over dt. So when you take this time derivative, it's proportional to omega. The displacement current is proportional to omega frequency. Therefore, when you move to the optical range, the displacement current becomes very large. And that's what we took advantage of. So actually, the conduction ohmic current is closed by the displacement current. So therefore, you have a closed loop. You have a current going around the loop. And therefore, you have mu. You have a resonance. These metal rods work as optical inductance. The gaps work as optical capacitance. You have like LC circuit, but in the optical range. So, and by changing the size, the geometry, you can have resonance at the frequency you want.
Why is the current not going on over from the top rod to the second rod? Why is it going only at the two ends?
It's actually, you're right, it goes everywhere. It's just like shown in the picture like this way.
If it goes everywhere, then you don't form a loops, then...
You just have a number of different loops. Okay? And I'm showing just one of those. And, it turns out that when both epsilon prime and mu prime are negative, that's sufficient condition. And in this case, indeed, n is negative. However, the necessary condition is not that restricting. It turns out that even if mu prime is positive, you still can have this inequality fulfilled. So then n is negative, but typically the figure of merit is low, meaning the imaginary part of n is relatively large. So that was actually the case in this experiment, in this first experiment. So we did obtain negative refractive index. It was small but negative. And for perpendicular polarization, when the electrical field is perpendicular to the rods, and then magnetic field does not penetrate through the pairs, so it doesn't induce any mu, so actually it looks like a transparent substrate. So there is no any resonance, nothing. Only for parallel polarization, you have very strong resonance in N. And so if you look at transmittance and reflectance, you see this very strong resonance at around 1.5 micron, which occurs for parallel polarization when you induce this LC resonance. And for perpendicular polarization, it's basically flat. It's a transmittance close to 100%, and reflectance is low. Nothing is happening there. So that's the whole thing occurs only for the right polarization. Yes?
In that first plot, it almost looks like N double prime goes negative.
Actually, it's not. It just goes close to zero, but it's not negative. So here is our simulations. Again, you can see that between the rod, the magnetic field looks against the applied magnetic field. So, and here it just I show specifically that the effect we obtained, -0.3. That was the first observation of negative refractive index in the optical range, specifically at 1.5 micron. Which is a telecommunication wavelength. Yeah. The figure of merit was low because the imaginary part was actually nearly 10 times larger than the real part. It's because we didn't have, mu was negative, but not at the same frequency as epsilon. So therefore, n was accomplished negative, but since mu still was positive, the figure of merit was low in that first experiment. Still, that was the first observation of negative refractive index in the optical range. So, and of course, since that time, I mean, things started to develop fast. So the other design, which was used by UNM group, University of New Mexico, and which is actually physically equivalent to the one we considered, What we took basically pairs of rods, or let's say pairs of these metal ellipsoids. But according to the Babinet principle, if you replace metal by dielectric, originally Babinet principle was formulated, you can have a metallic thing can consider diffraction around that metallic screen, or you can take a hole in the metallic screen, and the diffraction is the same, basically. So that's the Babinet principle. But it's formulated for ideal metal. We don't have ideal metal here, but still, roughly physically, it's equivalent. So instead of this having two metal rods, parallel rods, you could take two metal films and etch dielectric voids. Here you have two dielectric voids, one on top of each other. And it turns out that these two systems are equivalent if you also change the polarization of light appropriately. And that was exactly the structure fabricated by University of New Mexico by a group led by Steve Brook. And so they obtained quite good negative refractive index in this case, going down to -3 at roughly 1.885 or so nanometers. Well, as I said, the problem in general here is that magnetic and electric resonance occur typically at different wavelengths, and we would love them to be at the same wavelengths, okay? Therefore, the idea to use, and that's what we all groups trying to do now, is for permittivity, we don't want to have a resonance. We just want to have negative epsilon. And you know that in metals, even if you take just bulk metal, according to the Drude formula, epsilon is negative there, is in the broad spectral range without any resonance. If frequency is lower than some fraction of plasma frequency, then you have negative epsilon. But for mu, you have a resonance at particular wavelengths of your interest. But for epsilon, it's everywhere negative. So then you, instead of having two resonances occurring at the same frequency, you have only one resonance. And for epsilon, you just put some metallic structure which provides negative broadband negative epsilon without any resonance. That's the idea. So then it would work like this. Epsilon is just negative, just simply broadband non-resonant diluted metal, and mu provides this resonance, so you would have a resonance like this. And that's exactly what was used in two type of structures. One is basically use our pairs of rods and combine with continuous wires. This continuous wires would give you simply negative epsilon, whereas pairs of rods used in this case only for negative mu. They also have negative, could have negative epsilon, but here the focus, you get this resonant negative mu for pairs of rods and background broadband negative epsilon with these wires. That idea was suggested by Sakulis, basically combine our pairs of rods with these continuous wires. Another famous structure is a fishnet structure. When you have these plates, which also again work like our rods, but instead of rods you have plates, and again you have this asymmetric current induced by magnetic field penetrating through the pairs of plates that gives you negative mu, and this continuous wires-like structure give you negative epsilon, broadband negative epsilon. When you combine the two, you have this so-called fishnet structure. I should emphasize this is very, very, very all recent. It's all done within the last 2 years. This is the structure which was proposed in my group. Again, you take these pairs of basically continuous strips, because that's work as rods, that provide negative mu. And you take films which provide negative epsilon. It turns out it's better to have not continuous films, but semi-continuous film, metal films. Let me explain why. If you have continuous metal films, they do give you negative epsilon. But at 1.5 micron, it would be like -100. Okay, with mu, with these parallel strips and asymmetrical currents, you can't get mu, let's say, -1. But epsilon would be like -100, mu would be like -1. It means that you never would match impedance of, let's say, of air, okay? Because impedance involves the ratio epsilon and mu. Okay, they have to be of the same magnitude roughly to match the impedance of air. Therefore, this structure, if it would be pure metal, it would reflect enormously. We don't want to have it. We want to have epsilon negative, but kind of comparable to mu, so that we would be able to match impedance. Therefore, you dilute this metal film. You make it semi-continuous. You mix it with semiconductor. And depending how much, some dielectric. And depending how much dielectric you put here, you can bring epsilon to negative but relatively low magnitudes. Let's say -1. same as mu. And then you can match impedance, and you can have this negative refractive index without much reflectance. Because if impedance is not matched, you have lots of reflectance. Okay, therefore, it is a smart design, actually. You have broadband epsilon, but not too large, so that you can not only have these both mu and epsilon negative, but they also would be about the same magnitude, so that you can match impedance and would not have much reflectance. So that's actually was published just this year. We have not done it experimentally. We started but not finished yet that experiment. Okay, this is the fishnet structure which I mentioned, which was fabricated by Karlsruhe group. And as of now, they obtained the largest figure of merit at 1.5 micron, which is, this is refractive. This is permeability. You see it's negative. This is permittivity. It's broadband and negative, as I said. No resonance. It's just broadband and negative. It's associated with these wires, with these narrow wires. And these parallel strips, which work exactly in the same fashion as our parallel roads, but they just kind of, if you slide the roads in the XY plane, you get this strip, right? So that's instead of taking roads, you slide it like this, you get strips. And see, if the magnetic field penetrates through these strips, you still get the same mu. So these parallel strips give you negative mu, as it's shown here. These narrow wires give you broadband epsilon. Since you have both epsilon and mu negative, you get negative refractive index. So what is important, the figure of merit, which is the ratio of the real part divided by the imaginary part, modulus of that. It gives you how good is, how strong is it, because you want not only to have negative real part, but you also want to have as small as possible imaginary part. So in the ratio of this, this is the figure of merit. And the figure of merit here was 3. So for the optical range, that's a spectacular result. So it means that the real part was 3 times larger in magnitude than the imaginary part, and it was negative, something around -2. This is kind of the state of the art, but things develop very fast now. It's still already a several months old result. And for example, it just looks like we just obtained a result with a similar figure of merit, but not at 1.5 micron, but at 800 nanometers, which would be the shortest material with a large figure of merit at the shortest wavelengths. So things, it's very competitive field, but things develop very fast here. And that's really fun to be here, like to work in this field, because every month you expect new results. And so things develop extremely fast. All right, and this Karlsruhe group also published a beautiful result that they actually managed to measure using interferometry. Let me not go into details, it will take too much time, directly the phase velocity and the group velocity. Remember that the phase velocity is directly related to the wave vector. Wave vector is proportional to the wave vector proportional to the refractive index, and it defines the phase velocity. If n is negative, the phase velocity is negative. The group velocity actually is what could be associated with the directional flux of energy, but not always, only under certain conditions. So what they obtain, actually, that there are some situations when phase velocity is negative, but group velocity is positive. And also there are some situations when both phase velocity and group velocity are negative. And to the best of my knowledge, this is the first experimental demonstration of any wave which would have simultaneously phase and group velocity negative. It's kind of interesting. It means that in this case, actually, the direction of where energy propagates, it's not given by the group velocity, because energy does not go in the opposite. It still goes, let's say, in the right direction, but both phase and group velocity going in the opposite direction. That's a very unusual situation. That was published, again, this year in Science.
And what takes information? Is it the group velocity?
Say it again?
What takes information from point A to point B?
So what they do, they actually measure, they have a pulse. And to measure the group velocity, they look at the peak of this pulse and look where it shifted. They actually measure the delay with some reference pulse. If it's moved to the if it's retarded, then you have a negative group velocity. But the thing is, for the group velocity, they think to look at it's the maximum of your pulse. Okay, whereas for phase, you just look really so how phase is shifted. Well, here is the summary where we stay now. This is our first experiment. which we posted at April 13th, nearly simultaneously, UNM in collaboration with Columbia did the experiment with this dielectric void. It's kind of inverted to our system. So we have metal rods, parallel rods, they have this parallel void. It's kind of inversion of our system. But they obtained better results. That's what happened in 2005. And in this year, so things developed, and you see that you have now significantly improved figure of merit, 3, which I mentioned already. And they just published, I'm not sure whether it's already in press, I saw that paper. It's on archive, but I'm not sure it's published or not, but it should come anytime soon. They reported negative refractive index at 780, which is the border of the visible, as I said. Unfortunately, the figure of merit is still low, meaning that the mu was positive in that experiment. It's still, that's what we are trying to do now in my lab, to have both epsilon and mu indivisible that would give you negative refractive index with large figure of merit. Well, I'm sure they're trying the same, so let's see who will do it first. So, but that's kind of where we are now. So in the, at around 1.5 micron, we already have a very good, strong negative refractive index with good figure of merit, but indivisible, we're just starting to work there. But I should say all these structures are kind of two-dimensional. It's not really like three-dimensional. The next step would be to make a three-dimensional structure, make it multi-layer. One could think, hey, if even with one layer you have such relatively low figure of merit, what could you expect for multi-layer structures? But the same people from Columbia and UNM did some simulations, and simulations show that if you have actually multi-layer structure, then the figure of merit becomes not smaller but larger, like 30, 35. And if this is true, then basically when we go from single layer to multi-layer structure, you make real three-dimensional material where you can see really like rays going wrong direction, all that stuff, then the figure of merit would be much better rather than worse. It's almost like counterintuitive, but that's what the simulation show. All right, but anyway, there is a big problem of losses. If we want to solve problem of losses, you cannot think of devices. Things can be spectacular here, like a super lens. You can image with sub-wavelength resolution. They can many do many other things, but you have to find a way to beat losses. So, and perhaps the way to do it, and nobody has done it so far, but that's in plan. That's what we plan to do, hopefully next year. So it's to combine this negative index material as pairs of roads with some gain material. Because we know that there are very good gain materials, semiconductor materials like quantum dots, or let's say polymers like pi-conjugated polymers, and or let's say semiconductor optical amplifiers. It's well known. So the idea is if you place, let's say, this negative index material on top of quantum well, such as indium gallium arsenide phosphide, which is semiconductor optical amplifiers, then when you excite this quantum well, either electrically or optically, you have this electron hole pairs, which they recombinate, so they provide the energy, which could compensate for losses associated with surface plasmons. Calculations show we need required gain in the scale of 100 to 10,000, and 10,000, it actually pushes the edge. It's kind of hard to obtain. What was obtained, it's like gain coefficient on the scale of 1,000. So you see, we kind of close. We need the best possible gain materials to compensate for losses in these structures. So this is like, you could also mix quantum dots with the negative index material, like spin coat, or you could actually spin coat these pi-conjugated polymers, which also provide enhancement. Another idea we are trying to do in collaboration with Vlasov from IBM, it's to place our negative index materials on a silicon waveguide where strong Raman amplification has been demonstrated. And that would be particularly good because these silicon waveguides, they're done for silicon chips, and that's for real photonic chips. So if you could incorporate this negative index material in photonic chips and change the refractive index, of course, it would give you another degree of freedom to control, to manipulate light in nanophotonic chips. That would be a fantastic thing to do. But to check the idea that in principle it can work, it took these parallel strips at the paper we published this year in JOSA, and we calculated that there could be situation when indivisible, both, this is what, this is, okay, this is mu, and this is epsilon. They're both negative. Okay, this is mu, you see it's negative. This is epsilon, this is negative. So the refractive index is also negative, and the impedance actually at the same wavelength can be close to 1, meaning there's no reflection. But still, of course, the imaginary part is huge here. And so what we did, we just calculated, if you place gain material in between, at what gain actually the imaginary part becomes 0? You remove completely the losses. So it turns out that if gain is, I believe 12,000 inverse centimeters, 12,000 inverse centimeters, then transmission becomes 100%, reflectance is 0, perfect impedance match, so that the imaginary part of refractive index goes to 0. I mean, if it would be, I mean, this is a theoretical project, calculations. But if you would be able to do this, that would be negative refractive index indivisible with no losses. Then, of course, spectacular new family of devices can be done with really, really exciting applications. And we already did this in collaboration with Norfolk State University, some work which has just appeared in Optics Letters. It's not about negative index materials. It's about these colloidal aggregates. But we showed that losses in surface plasmon in that case can be really compensated significantly. In that particular experiment, dye molecules were used. So the idea is for host material, use not passive host material, but active host material, which you can pump either electrically or optically. And that energy from host material could compensate that emission from host material losses associated with surface plasmons. And that you, in the end, you would get negative index material with no losses or very low losses. This is the big project which we are working now on. If we succeed, I think that would really enable a number of really new devices. Okay, so what kind of devices? Let me briefly describe this perfect lens, which I mentioned several times already. How conventional lens work? Okay, if you have an object, okay, and you irradiate it with light, okay, and then the z component of wave vector, if you look at the Maxwell's equation, actually can be presented like this, and you can see where k naught is simply omega over c. Okay, you can see that this transverse component of the wave vector, kx and ky, if the size of the feature you want to resolve is smaller than the wavelengths, okay? This is the size of the feature, okay? Let's say you want to see some small things here which is much smaller than the wavelengths. If it's smaller than the wavelength, that the corresponding transverse vector would be larger than omega over c, right? If the size of, in R space, smaller than the wavelengths, it means that in the inverse space, k would be larger than k naught, where k naught is omega over c. So which means that here you would have kx and ky squared together larger than k naught squared together, meaning that you have here a negative number and that would exponentially decay. That all illustrates the idea that in conventional optics, you cannot resolve features smaller than the wavelength. They exponentially decay. If I take an image, let's say, of you, I can resolve big features like eyes, eyebrow, but I cannot resolve, let's say, down to DNAs which you are built of. It's simply because those things are too small. The wave vectors which describe those small things are much larger than k naught, and therefore those components exponentially decay. They are evanescent. And that's famous diffraction limit. You cannot resolve features smaller than the wavelengths. It turns out that's for conventional lens, okay? If you take a lens with refractive index minus 1, those components which exponentially decay start exponentially regrow inside of this lens, if n is equal really minus 1. And what could happen then behind the lens, it could have exactly the same amplitude as it had here in the object plane. So in the image plane, you actually restore the fields which you have in the image, in the object plane. Of course, it's ideally. It would happen if they would not have any losses. But losses actually extremely detrimental. Even small amount of losses makes it all impossible. Therefore, we are so keen on removing losses. So this is just another illustration of the same idea. Let's say my object is a diffraction grating. And let's say this feature, the period of this gradient, is smaller than the wavelengths. How do we describe this gradient? It's simply this Fourier decomposition, okay? Where Q is transverse wave vector. Again, if the size of this feature is smaller than the wavelength, then Q would be larger than omega over C. N is refractive index of air, it's 1. So, and you have this exponential decay. However, within the material, within the lens, since refractive index is negative, this is the phase acquired in air, but within the lens where refractive index is negative, you have to change the sign here because that's proportional to the, you see, instead of going this way, it goes this way. Clearly that the sign should be different. And you change the sign here as well. So therefore, these two phases completely compensate each other. And you have extremely unusual situation. You could think of this super lens as a negative space, optically negative space, because optically, when you speak of space, you speak of n refractive index times the distance over which your light propagated. That's what in the Fermat's principle. That's when you consider the Fermat principle, you consider it's called optical length, which is n times distance. So here you have optically negative space. Here you have optically positive space. And these two parts of space annihilate each other completely. And you have here the phase exactly the same as here, like light didn't propagate at all. You have positive, negative space compensating the positive space, and as a result, in the image plane, you have exactly the same phase as light didn't propagate at all. And in that sense, it's different from anything else. So it's ideally, if there wouldn't be losses, the way this thing would work, it's almost like kind of fantastic. You really kind of compensate the positive space with negative space. Yes?
Could you see near fields without being in the near field? Yes, okay. Does that make sense?
Well, in principle, if this thing works, when you say this question, I'm not sure what exactly you mean. Can you see near field without being in near field? I mean, in principle, in this with this particular design, you completely restore the fields, which include all the components, those which you associate with the near field and with the far field. And you restore it in, ideally in the any point of space. Well, not at any point of space, but let's say the condition which needs to be fulfilled is clearly sealed from this structure. This distance A and this distance B should be exactly equal to the thickness of your lens. That's where this complete restoration occurs. But in the image plane, the restoration is complete. You have exactly the same field distribution as in the object plane. But unfortunately, because of losses, this thing works so far only for the near zone. In the far zone, nobody demonstrated it because losses are extremely detrimental. As soon as you introduce a little bit losses, you cannot really fulfill this condition. So this is the first demonstration of this super lens in the near zone. Why in the near zone it's easier to do? And what I mean by near zone? I mean that all the distances are much smaller than the wavelengths. In this case, electrical interaction to the electrical component of light and magnetic component of light are decoupled completely. So you mu is irrelevant. You can have only epsilon equal minus epsilon h. So the condition n equal minus 1 is reduced to epsilon equal minus 1. Mu is irrelevant in the near zone because the interaction to electrical and magnetic component of lights are decoupled. Or you could think in a different way. In the near zone, if you have, let's say, dipole moment, electrical dipole moment, in the near zone, there is no any magnetic field. All the interaction would be purely electrical. So, and in this case, it was, this idea was also proposed by Pendray. So he proposed also the far zone super lens and the near zone super lens. And what he described in his original paper, he would take the object which consisted of two slits, and he would put a silver slab which plays the role of this lens with epsilon equal minus epsilon h. And then without this lens, you cannot actually resolve at this distance these slits. Your image looks like this. But if you place the silver slab, which works as this super lens, you can clearly resolve this two slits. That was the idea. And here's the experimental demonstration which was done by Shang Zhen group at UCLA at that time. Now he's with Berkeley. So he wrote this NANA. I mean, simply just using the beam lithography, he made this NANA. And when he placed this silver slab, which worked as this super lens, he got image of that at the other side of the super lens. But all sizes here are smaller than the wavelengths. This is the near field super lens, I want to emphasize. So it means that you're very close to the lens, and you look at the image also very close behind the lens. So, and that nearly simultaneously, Richard Blakey in New Zealand also demonstrated this super resolution in the near zone. And in mid-infrared, Svets, and his in collaboration with German group at 10 microns, also showed this, that super resolution can be accomplished also in the near zone. They use a special material, silicon carbide, which has very strong negative epsilon at around 10 microns. Well, the problem is this particular super lens, that this condition when epsilon equal minus epsilon H, this is just the Drude formula with specific numbers characteristic for silver. You can see that it's fulfilled when it's equal, let's say, to minus 2, let's say, for silica at only particular frequency. And it turns out to be 350 nanometers, roughly, which is near UV. And you cannot, and it wouldn't be work at any other wavelengths. So the idea, which actually came from my group, and Vinshan Tsai actually was the one who did this project, he said the condition for super lens, near field super lens, is the effective permittivity of your lens should be equal minus epsilon H, where H is the host, could be air, for example. So, but for bulk metal, it's fixed. I mean, then it's only one wavelength it could be fulfilled. What we suggested, why don't we have not bulk silver super lens, but kind of composite super lens like this one? Again, it's a mixture of, let's say, silver or gold with some dielectric like glass. And then changing the metal filling factor, we can make epsilon effective equal to minus epsilon H at any wavelengths. So the difference with traditional super lens that now by varying the metal filling factor, we can realize this super lens at any wavelengths of interest. And so this is just illustrated to you by changing the metal filling factor, you can move the real part of epsilon and you can have it equal to the epsilon of host at any wavelengths. So let me not go into details with this. This shows that by varying the metal filling factor, you can see that the wavelengths at which super lens operates can be varied between 0.470 nanometer to 1.1 micron. It covers the whole visible and part of near infrared range. So, and this is illustration that such super lens can work, for example, for 632 nanometers, which is red line. So without a super lens, you cannot resolve these two slits. Again, we have the same two slits which are separated by 40 nanometers. By placing our composite super lens, you do resolve these slits. The difference with what Shang Zhen group did is that in our case, it was near UV, and he could not vary the wavelengths. In our case, it's any wavelengths we want to have, because instead of bulk silver material, we use composite material, and therefore we can fulfill condition for this super resolution at any wavelength by simply varying the metal filling factor.
How is the minus the negative mu affected?
Well, in this case, again, I'm speaking of only near field super lens where mu doesn't play any role. You do need mu when you want to obtain super resolution in the far zone. So then you do need mu. So in this case, everything is smaller than the wavelengths. Therefore, n equal minus 1 is reduced to epsilon equal minus 1. And what I'm talking here about, that epsilon equal minus 1 for composite super lens, as opposed to bulk metal like silver, can be fulfilled at any wavelengths. That's the advantage. And there are very interesting applications of this type of super lens, which again we're trying to pursue in our lab. So for example, you can do this surface enhanced spectroscopy we were talking about. If you place like molecules on some metal film, you usually get dramatically enhanced fields and you can do sensing. But unfortunately, when you place molecule on the metal films, they change their structure dramatically. Sometimes they're denatured, proteins can be denatured. So you would like to get this enhancement coming from metallic structure, but you don't want to place molecule right on the metal. Therefore, what you could play, the trick you could play, you put here the substrate, which provides enhancement for local field. Then you put here this super lens, and here you have your molecules, so that the enhanced field are projected from here to here, so that the molecules, biomolecules, do feel enhanced field, but they're not in contact with the metal. So it's contact-free surface-enhanced spectroscopy. This, we have not done it yet, but this is the project. You can do even more interesting things. Like, let's say you want to look inside of a cell, and you don't, and that thing is small. How you could do it? You could do it with a tip of near-field optical microscope, but if you place a tip inside of a cell, you would break it. I mean, you would kill the cell. So what we could do, we could take a cell, image it, the other field of the super lens, and then scan that cell with a tip of near-field optical microscope. But you scan not the cell itself, but its image. It's intact imaging of inner structure of a cell by using the super lens. Okay, I'm just showing that this super lens, of course, a very, very important thing. And of course, you can do nanophotolithography by using this super lens. All right, and actually, I rushed too much, so I left too much time for optical clocking. Optical clocking, it's going to be presented next Tuesday. I just provide short introduction to this yet new field. There are only few papers appeared in this area so far, and I would predict will be the next booming area. So I mean, because clocking is, as I said, it's almost like fantastic, almost like not real thing. And it turns out that at least theoretically, with metamaterials, you can do this clocking. And that all comes down to the fact that these optical metamaterials provide unprecedented control of electromagnetic field. By playing with epsilon and mu, you can actually control electromagnetic waves in the way which never was possible. So, and the idea, can we really force light to move in direction, in such a direction that, let's say, a particular object would not be visible? So, like making rays bent around the object so that you would not be able to see that object. And of course, there are lots of history into this. This famous Perseus helmet in Greek mythology, when he was fighting against famous Medusa the Gorgon, and he killed her. But then when they chased the guy, he put this helmet on his hand and became invisible, and therefore he safely actually escaped. The other famous thing is the ring of Kyges in famous Plato's book, The Republic, the same Plato, the philosopher, ancient philosopher Plato. And the story goes like a peasant finds this ring on a tomb of a king, and then use this ring, put it on the finger, and becomes invisible. The same idea which was, of course, used later in this Lord of the Ring and many other things. That's the ring. And of course, the more recent thing is this Harry Potter's invisibility cloak, which he inherited from his father. So he would put that on himself and become invisible. And that's the thing. So that would be very nice. You can imagine how people from the army would be happy to have this type of clothes for soldiers. There's this game. I really don't know this game. I'm not into this. The stealth shield of not you. Maybe you know. So, but my student Vincent Tsai just pointed this. I don't know this. There are a couple of things which I really would like to mention here. The famous novel by Herbert Wells, written in the end of 19th century. It's called The Invisible Man, and it's actually quite interesting. I forgot the name of the main character of that novel, but he would use some chemical stuff to put on his body to decrease the refractive index so that it would become the same as of the air. But that's actually, the idea he would become invisible. It's not exactly right, but it's right to some extent. If you really match the impedance of air, then there is no reflection. The idea is right, actually, to the extent that that's the way to remove reflectance. So in this particular novel, The Invisible Man, there was exactly right idea. If you match impedance, there is no reflection. It means at least you would not be visible in that direction. Let's say if light goes like this, you cannot see me in that direction. And that was actually spelled out, surprisingly. This, guy who had nothing to do with physics spelled out the very right idea. But even more surprisingly, this is The Invisible Woman. And that's a relatively recent novel. I believe it was published in the 50s in this country. But here the idea is exactly the same as we are about to discuss. This woman was capable to bend rays around her body. So they don't go into body, they just bend. But that's exactly the idea of the cloaking. Basically, these two novels suggest completely the idea of cloaking. If you can match the impedance, no reflectance, if you can bend rays around the object, and so they would propagate so that the object actually was not there at all, so no any perturbation, then it would make object invisible. So I'm just saying that sometimes it's kind of funny that things which basically come from the literature are so exactly to the point and might become real. And who knows? Maybe within 5 years or so we will get this cloaking. We have already something, but complete cloaking. All right, so this is what really people do now already in this direction. This is, there are very many things related to cloaking, and we need to really define what we mean by this. So, of course, there is this stealth technique, and the idea here that you use non-metallic frame, some absorbing paint, so that In the direction where radiation comes to detect your plane, it doesn't scatter back. So you actually have to remove scattering back. So you could scatter in all directions, you could absorb it, but you don't want to reflect radiation exactly to the source. That's kind of stealth program. Okay, stealth, there is nothing really mysterious, so you just try to decrease as much as possible any electromagnetic energy going backward, back to the source. So you can do absorb, you can do scattering, you can do this non-metallic frame, shape effect. So that's famous F117, Nighthawk. But in nature we have a very familiar things, which is natural camouflage. This is so-called chameleon. So the thing is, look, this creature actually is able to change its color to match the color of the surrounding where it's located. Like in this case, so there's some branches, some green leaves, and it exactly has the color of these greens, and that's camouflage. You cannot see it well. So because you match kind of the optical properties of surrounding material. This comes back to Herbert Wells' novel. Okay, that's really, it's hard to see in terms of reflection. Of course, there is black hole. The black hole is simply you have so much mass that nothing goes out of there. That's a little bit hard to fabricate, but another thing is this optical camouflage. That's kind of a very stupid idea, but it also works. So what in this case you do, so you basically put a camera behind that man, and that camera just tapes all that, takes image of the objects behind, and then projects it into a person, which the closest works as a screen, basically. So you have a camera, it takes image what is behind, and it projects that image into the screen, which is the close of this guy. So, it looks like the guy is not there and you see what the object is behind. It's kind of stupid, but that's the optical camouflage. And that's actually how it works in reality. You can see it. What should I do to make it? Maybe I should here double click. Yeah, it's usually movie doesn't work. Okay, there is. So there was a movie here. Sorry, it doesn't work. All right. So the point which I'm trying to make here, cloaking is not the same as invisibility. So actually, what we are trying to claim here is much bigger than just camouflage. So Camouflage is basically an adaptation to the surrounding environment. To kind of match what is around you, so it's hard. So if the optical contrast is, if there is no optical contrast, if your refractive index is the same of the surrounding host, then you basically, it's hard to see. Cloaking is something different. It's, there is no need to adapt to a particular environment with the ultimate goal of transparency. In this case, there is no scattering and no shade. So complete cloaking, ideal cloaking. I mean, there shouldn't be any scattering, no any shade. So therefore, there is no way actually to detect the object. So that, here is the criteria for an ideal cloak. It has to be microscopic, okay, so that you could cloak, let's say, a big object, such as a soldier, for example. There shouldn't be limit to sub-wavelength size, because there are several projects how you can make invisible small things, like a nanoparticle, which is relatively easy. I mean, that can be done. Like you take a metal particle with negative epsilon, just coat it with some dielectric which has positive epsilon. So in total, on average, it would have like epsilon equal 1. The same as air. And then that's actually, I mean, if air has epsilon 1 and your metal coated with some dielectric has average epsilon equal 1, then you don't see it. But that can be done only for very small particle. It's not that of that much interest. So we are speaking of macroscopic cloaking. It should be, I mean, cloaking should be done for object of any shape which you place inside of this cloaking structure. So it shouldn't depend on the shape. So absorption should be minimized and scattering should be minimized. And it, in principle, it should be broadband because, I mean, when you look at object, there is the visible, which is a broadband. It should not work only for one single wavelength. And the demonstration so far, they all limited to single polarization, single wavelength. When I say the demonstration so far, it's actually one or two. So they're not much done yet. There is, of course, in nature kind of relevant thing, which is called desert mirage. So in this case, because there is a gradient in the refractive index, so this is, there is very high temperature close to the surface. The air is hot and the refractive index is, becomes larger and then it becomes progressively smaller. So the thing is that rays, instead of going this way, actually go this way. And therefore, the observer thinks that this particular object is not here, but somewhere here. But it's this indicates that if I would have some object here, forget that there is a ground, let's say this is just a space, he would not be able to see it because rays would go around this that particular area. So it just simply rays kind of bent around a particular area, and if for that particular position, he would not be able to see it. And here is the really the ultimate cloaking as was proposed this year in two papers simultaneously published in Nature or Science, I forgot. Was it Nature or Science? Science. So one by Pendry, Smith, Shurik, and another one by the guy from the Netherlands. I can't pronounce his name. What?
Leonhard.
Yeah, Leonhard, yeah. So, and they actually proposed exactly the same idea, but expressed it in different terms. So in very general terms, next Tuesday, we will consider it more details. So if you, in homogeneous space, rays propagate like this, just straight line. Or it could be actually, it could represent any particular field. If you kind of distort in a smart way epsilon mu, it's not constant anymore, but kind of vary in space in a special way, then you can make rays, force rays to go along certain trajectories so that some particular area could be cloaked and rays cannot go inside. And again, without any explanation, I leave it for the next lecture. You can make such a situation when, which is shown here as from that paper. Then rays, this is the cloaking object, which is a kind of sphere-like object. You see, rays go like this. Outside of the object, they're completely not perturbed, like nothing exists here. And most importantly, field doesn't penetrate at all into the cloaking region. If I place anything here, it wouldn't be seen. If there is no field, there is no any response. But don't be confused. It's not as simple as, let's say, to put a superconductor something here like this, because then you would have either a shade effect or reflectance. In this case, there is no reflectance. No any shade. the outside of the clocking range, everything is like nothing exists there in this space. Okay, and here the field is zero. So therefore, you cannot see anything what is inside, and no perturbation at all. This is true ultimate clocking. And at least theoretically, here we go. But that's also they already made the very first experiment. It's not even published, it's pre-published. It's how it's called, it's pre-publishing. They place it on the web, it's not even out in the press. So they made this, you see the same splitting crisanator structure. They made this cylindrical type of structure. And that works for microwave, for only particular polarization, TE polarization. And what they showed that the rays go, well, not perfectly, but pretty much not that much distortion occurs here. You see, you kind of surround the clocking range and no field inside. That's really important. And then they propagate like there is nothing, no any disturbing object was here. That's not complete clocking. It's, as I said, it works for single polarization, single wavelengths in microwave range. And there's still reflection here, by the way. There's impedance not perfectly matched. But this is the very first thing which just appeared, and it brought lots of excitement. And of course, we jumped on this project, and one of my students, Vinshan Tsai, already came with the idea how to do it in the optical range, which I'm not going to discuss with you. We are just preparing a paper on this subject. So, but that's going to be big. So that's lots of excitement here. All right. So enough said about this. Just as a one of the final slides, or maybe it is the final, showing that this area of metamaterials, it's kind of, it draws lots of attention. Because, I mean, it excites imagination of people. I mean, like bending rays, making them go in their own direction, super lens imaging with resolution smaller than the wavelengths, making objects invisible. And it's really, when I told this story to my daughter, she said, wow, looks like I got first time respect from you. She would say, oh, may I tell this to my boyfriend? I said, no, you may not. So it's exciting. I mean, it's really exciting, and I'm just sharing with you this excitement when you work on things where you can so dramatically affect very basic properties. I mean, like controlling light, the way it propagates, the way you see object, the way you resolve the images. So that's very, very exciting. And it's this new thing that you can control epsilon mu, you can bring them into the negative range. You can make refractive index negative. And then as a result, you can really do so many new things. I didn't mention lots of them. You can do actually various type of nano antennas. You can do waveguides, which are much smaller than the wavelengths. So many things which were absolutely unthinkable before. So might become possible with metamaterials. But I don't want to bring too much hype. There are so many problems to be solved before. But as I said already several times, at least fundamentally, from the theoretical point of view, it looks like it's doable. So the next stage, the next problem to overcome is to come up with the right design, with the right materials, and to make it happen. So here you can see the number of publications. All started in year 2000, which really exponentially grew. This year is not finished yet. That actually was in September. So it's clearly exponential growth of interest in the number of publications in the area of metamaterials. And as I said, metamaterials is just a part of general area, which is our course, which we call nanophotonics. So in a sense, you could call it ultimate nanophotonics, because you control parameters in this case to kind of ultimate degree, if you wish. All right, and take-home messages for this particular couple lectures. So these negative index materials with both mu negative and n negative have been demonstrated in the visible and in the optical range. That's all very recent. It's like this or last year demonstration. So remember, I emphasize the point that by doing these materials with mu different from one, we actually giving light the second hand, because otherwise in the optical range, light interacts with atoms only with its electrical component, whereas the interaction to the magnetic component is small by this fine structure constant, which is small, 1 over 137. And you have to actually square that. So with metamaterials, both components of light interact with meta atoms. And the idea, you create these artificial atoms, which are still much smaller than the wavelengths, but much larger than the size of a single atom, and have pre-designed properties which you want, engineered properties. And in this particular case, you make them have magnetic response at optical frequency. So one of the spectacular applications is related to this superlens. We also discuss how you can control the frequency of the superlens by basically taking, instead of bulk silver film, just composite silver silica film, and just controlling the filling factor of metal, you can control the frequency at which the superlens operates. I pointed out that one of the major problems with these metamaterials is losses. And it looks like the problem can be solved, addressed by using gain materials. Nobody has done it so far, but we hope to be able to do it. And if you will do, or somebody else will do it, then of course real devices would become possible. We do need to get rid of losses. Well, I didn't discuss with you completely this nonlinear optics. Nonlinear optics becomes very, very interesting and exciting with this negative index material, but that goes outside of this course. So, and then I mentioned some kind of interesting applications related to this negative refractive index phenomenon, which is interesting by itself. It's fun. But there are such applications as nanoscale imaging. In other words, imaging with resolution beyond the wavelengths. You can also do sensing, as I mentioned, with resolution beyond the wavelengths, optical sensing. You can do photolithography. You can do nanophotonics. Again, we didn't discuss it, but I just mentioned that you can make waveguides much smaller than the wavelengths. You can make new sources based on these metamaterials. And one of the most exciting things, which kind of brings future and reality, let's say fantastic and reality together, it's this clocking idea. And that remains to be seen to what extent it can be realized, but we're all excited just working in this area. So that's it for this lecture. And we start now with your presentation. And the next one will be exactly the subject of clocking. Any questions? All right, thank you. See you next Tuesday.